Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com. From the jury selection, to the opening arguments, to the witness testimony and cross-examination, and the prosecution's case and the defense's case, and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
Hello, and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest. April 4th, 2024, Florida bans abortion again, edition. I'm David Plotz, CityCast in Washington, D.C. My two dear comrades left Washington, gone back to their homes. That means Emily Bazelon of Yale and the New York Times Magazine is back in New Haven, Connecticut. Hello, Emily.
Hello, David.
And back in Manhattan, the ovary of the universe, John Dickerson of CBS Primetime. Hello.
That was a discarded slogan from the 70s.
It was, I love New York or the ovary of the universe.
Yeah.
One or the other.
It wouldn't fit on a t-shirt, so they went with the other one.
I never thought about how different the world would be if it was called Womanhattan. To be pondered.
Well, we've got one for the conundrum show.
Whoa. This week on the Gabfest, will Florida's six-week abortion ban and abortion referendum galvanize Democrats and turn that state blue? Probably not, but it's a good question to ask. Then we'll be joined by Omar Tijani to talk about the Israel war in Gaza and the ramifications of the Israeli attack that killed seven World Central Kitchen workers. Then what would a Biden economy look like in 2026, 2027? And what about a Trump economy? What would that look like in 2026 and 2027? We will speculate and discuss based on evidence. Plus, we will have cocktail chatter. This episode of the Gabfest is sponsored by Home Chef. Are you drowning in a sea of meal kit options? Feeling like you're in a bad dating game where every contestant looks the same? Fear not. Amid the chaos, there's one shining star worth your affection, your culinary affection, and that's Home Chef. Home Chef is absolutely delightful as a meal kit. I had two of the best meal kit meals, the best, in fact, not even of the best. I had the two best meal kit meals I've ever had last week with Home Chef. I had a spicy blood orange pistachio pork chop that had also a Brussels and potato hash with it that was just stunning. It was absolutely stunning. And then we had a maple glazed yellowtail on another night, which was also delicious. The blood orange pistachio recipe was very fun to make. They said it was going to take 25 to 35 minutes. It took me 30 minutes on the dot. The ingredients were spectacularly good. I'm going to be straight up about this. I'm a really good cook, but I'm often frustrated with recipes and how unclear they are. The recipe description and this kind of step-by-step instructions for Home Chef were so good. They were done by somebody who had clearly like thought about this, thought about the user experience, and crushed it with it. Home Chef has fresh ingredients, chef-designed recipes. It's delivered right to your doorstep. And there's a whole different varieties. If you like classic meal kits with pre-portioned ingredients and easy instructions, if you want a recipe that's ready in less than 30 minutes, if you want an oven-ready recipe with pre-chopped ingredients, if you want a quick microwave meal, they've got you covered. No matter what the kind of meal, what the style of meal, who you're serving, how quickly you need to make it. They have over 30 options a week, and they serve a variety of dietary needs too, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. And it's not just convenient, it's also economical. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. For a limited time, Home Chef is offering GabFest listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life. And of course, free shipping on your first box. Free dessert for life. For life. Go to homechef.com/GabFest. That's homechef.com/GabFest for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard that right. homechef.com/GabFest. You must be an active subscriber to receive free dessert. So much happened at the Florida Supreme Court this week. F. SCOTUS, by a 6-1 margin, the conservative court found that the state constitution's right to privacy did not, in fact, protect a right to abortion. That effectively triggered a 6-week abortion ban passed by the GOP-controlled legislature. At the same time, or roughly the same time, the court ruled 4-3 that a voter referendum to enshrine a right to abortion in the Constitution would be on the ballot in November, where it would require a 60% margin to pass. So, John, abortion rights is a motivator for Democrats, and abortion referenda have brought voters out. Does the fact that Florida now has one of the strictest abortion bans in the country, imposed by Republican legislators and Republican judges, and that there is a voter referendum on the ballot that people are going to perhaps come out and vote for, mean that Florida is now in play either for the Senate or for more House seats or more speculatively for the presidency?
I mean, my instinct is to say probably not. For the presidency, I don't know about down ballot races. I think there is a Florida effect in the rest of the country, though. I mean, I think what will happen in Florida, Donald Trump's, he already said that he opposed the 6-week ban that DeSantis supported because of their competition during the primary, which finally put him on the record about abortion, which he's been trying to have all sides of. And so I think the referendum in Florida and the Supreme Court's decision on 6 weeks in Florida, combined with the 6-week ban in Georgia and just the kind of general set of issues, I think spills over into the national conversation. But I feel like it sorts and has more influence there than in the state. But I'm hoping Emily has a more specific answer.
Well, here's a kind of counterpoint, which is, so first of all, abortion rights definitely seemed to matter in Michigan a couple of years ago. Gretchen Whitmer won re-election by like 10 points, and the Democrats in Michigan flipped both state houses for the first time since the 1980s. So that's just one data point, but it's interesting.
But they're not the same state. I mean, they're totally different makeups of the parties in the states, or are you saying they are similar?
No, I'm just, I mean, you know, Michigan is purple. I mean, Florida's red. So I think that's why your point stands, but I'm just putting that out there. The second thing, though, I think matters both for Florida and for the national point you just made, which is that abortion rights really poll well for Democrats right now. They're not polling super salient. That is to say, when you ask voters what are the most important issues, they're pretty low on the list. That may surprise some of our listeners, but that is the case. And so news like this with the ban that, you know, will seem extreme to a lot of people, not to mention out of character for Florida, like really, given Florida's history as being a place where abortion has been legal up to 24 weeks, where women have traveled from the South even before Dobbs in 2022, it's pretty surprising. And so that may help Democrats just by reminding them that this issue is alive and well and important.
There are also referendums, it looks like, that are going to head to the ballot in Arizona and Nevada.
And Missouri, possibly, maybe. And some other states, possibly. So, yes.
But Arizona and Nevada, I was pointing out, because those are two states that matter in the presidential election enormously. So both of you seem to agree that it's not, that it probably is not hugely consequential for the Florida vote, but that it helps for Democrats create an environment where abortion is more salient, where the threat to abortion rights is more salient, and therefore it's more top of mind for more voters. And that possibly is, that benefits Democrats because it presumably encourages women especially to come out and vote and for a Democratic-leaning issue.
Can I add one more complication? The people running the ballot measure are going to steer away from partisanship because abortion rights are also popular among lots of Republicans, and they are going to want to say this is not an issue that's about Democrats versus Republicans. At the same time, the Biden campaign already put up an online ad about abortion rights and is going to, you know, wrap itself in this. So, but then third, to go back to John's point about how Florida is red, I think Biden lost Florida by 3 points, right? So like, that's a lot of ground to make up. And isn't the Florida Democratic Party just kind of in disarray generally?
The challenger is somebody I'd literally never heard of, which is, that's a bad news for Florida if I haven't heard of the challenger.
Well, that's because they don't, I think their primary's not until August of 2024. But there's not a clear front runner, or to the extent there is a clear front runner, it's not a candidate who's going to set the world on fire beating Rick Scott.
I would like to talk about a couple of things. First of all, Florida has a 60% threshold for referendums, at least this one, I assume for all of them, which seems like maybe that's okay.
No, bad. Continue.
But don't they also have a history of just functionally undoing them? Wasn't the referendum that allowed ex-felons to vote effectively gutted by the
legislature? The legislature effectively undid it. That ballot initiative was vulnerable because of the way it was written. It's pretty technical. Let's not explain the whole thing. But I don't think that means that this ballot initiative, which is written actually very clearly, the language of the Florida ballot initiative is so much clearer than any of the others, remarkably so. And so it's supposed to be defended against such a problem.
Can we, on the just on the national abortion picture, kind of just reflect for a moment on the way in which, despite what we've said about Florida politics, that the change in abortion politics, the extent to which Democrats are using it as an issue and have some possibility to use it not only just as an issue about reproductive rights, but about the larger picture they want to paint about Republicans. Just the issue has totally flipped in the sense, you know, the Dobbs decision in terms of which party wants to talk about abortion and which doesn't, and which it might help and which doesn't. And there is some complexity on the right when we see the difficulty Donald Trump is having and trying to hold all different positions between Republicans and the anti-abortion forces that have supported them for so many years, who would like them to talk about it more, and they don't want to.
Emily, am I correct in thinking that the Florida legislature is just exceptionally good at banning abortion, that they seem to have passed a 15-week ban and then been like, oh, let's put a cherry on top of it and we'll pass a 6-week ban that triggers when the Supreme Court comes out? They're real pros at it.
Well, yeah, I mean, DeSantis made it a priority. And the Florida legislature passes lots of super conservative things, which, again, you know, the history of Florida. So Florida had an increase in abortions after Dobbs, not surprisingly, because women from all over the place in the South have been traveling there for abortions. But it also has been a haven for abortion, like, since the 70s. And they're just, I understand that Florida has turned red, but this kind of conservatism still seems surprising, even with all of the don't say gay laws and the school moves to the right we've seen. I just really wonder if this is what the people of Florida want. Then, of course, the question becomes like, well, maybe they don't want it, but what do they actually do about it?
And also, there's been some underestimating of the power of the pro-abortion rights side. I mean, every single state, is it right, Emily, that's held an abortion rights referendum since Roe fell, it hasn't even been close. The pro-abortion rights side has won by a big margin. So even if Florida doesn't turn red for the presidential race, there's a chance that this could be another, you know, even given the 60% threshold, this could still be another one of those instances in which the abortion rights supporters win again.
Right. And that's the thing about these ballot initiatives. You can target the particular issue, right? So Floridians may keep their legislature, they may keep their Republican governor, but they can actually just change this one thing. And you're right. I mean, the reason I said I think the 60% threshold is bad is I think generally it's anti-democratic to have a supermajority. Like, that's just a general feeling or position I would take in the world. And yet it is true at the same time that abortion rights have been polling above 60% in Florida. So it could pass despite this higher threshold.
I guess I don't agree with you, or I'm not sure I agree with you that a 60% threshold is so terrible. I don't think we don't want a lot of direct democracy in this country. Direct democracy is not so awesome. I mean, representative democracy doesn't seem so hotsy-totsy at the moment either. But direct democracy, I mean, we had that situation in California for a while where there were just ballot initiatives galore. Every time you turn around, there was a ballot initiative. And where really dramatic things could happen by motivating, you know, 50% of the people who bother to turn out in some special election to come out and vote for it. And you could radically reshape what the state did on certain policies. And I don't know.
You're thinking particularly, I think, of the property tax initiative in California, which hamstrung the government forever and continues to do so. California is sort of its own animal. There's so much money at stake that then tons of money pours in, and they still have gazillion ballot initiatives. You know, there are other ways you can kind of tinker with this. You can raise the threshold for the number of signatures you have to get onto the ballot. That makes it more expensive to get onto the ballot. I don't think we have seen ballot initiatives like widely abused in lots of states. But I mean, what you're saying is a totally sound sense to have.
Can we close by talking actually about what will happen to women who would have sought an abortion in Florida now? So there were 80,000 abortions in Florida. This will cut the number significantly. Based on what we've seen from a state like Texas, say, what is going to happen? And Emily, I'm really interested in the question of, We've talked so much about medication abortion being prescribed across state lines by doctors and providers in states with shield laws. How does that information get to women in Florida? Does it pass very quickly? Is it universally known? Like, how do people find out that, okay, I'm pregnant, it's 7 weeks, what am I going to do?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think, honestly, the biggest tool for abortion pills to be distributed into red states is just like the press and social media and information. And there are groups, one of them is called Plan C, another one is called Mayday Health, where like this is what they do. They spread information about abortion pills and how you get them. And if you go online and you type in, I need an abortion, sites come up. And then also now in Florida, if you're scrambling around after 6 weeks, hopefully you will get information about how to receive abortion pills from whatever healthcare provider you go to for help. And I think also the Supreme Court case about mifepristone, one of the pills, has been really helpful in getting information about abortion pills into the headlines.
Can I make one more just political point, which I think is important? 62% of Floridians at the end of last year said in, I can't remember what poll it was, but that they would support such an abortion referendum. The pollings suggest they could clear the 60% threshold. Secondly, remember Todd Akin? I was reminded this by somebody. He ran for Senate in Missouri.
And Legitimate rape.
Well done. And that's a sharper way of me talking about, even if Florida doesn't go blue in the presidential, and the Biden administration, obviously, or Biden campaign is saying, we're going to really compete for Florida, which could be a head fake. Why not get your guy to, you know, your opponent to spend a lot of money holding down Florida? But so we'll see if it's for real. But Rick Scott in a race, you know, could say something not so great about abortion. And even if it doesn't risk his race, it can slop over into other races, the way in which legitimate rape by Todd Akin in a Missouri race ended up hurting Republicans more broadly across the country.
I want to give a huge thank you to our Slate Plus listeners. You have helped us keep doing the Gabfest for so long, and you get so much great stuff for your subscription. Bonus segments on every episode, special discounts for live shows. I listened to a fantastic Hang Up and Listen bonus segment this week. It was such a treat. That was a treat for me as a Slate Plus member. And you don't hit the paywall on the Slate site if you're a Slate Plus member. And this week for our Slate Plus segment, we're going to be talking about the eclipse. A lot of thoughts about the eclipse. If you are a member, again, thank you. Enjoy that. If you are not a member, go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to become a member today. That's slate.com/GabFestPlus. This episode is brought to you by Wondery. With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI simultaneously terrified and entranced the world with our fears and excitement about artificial intelligence. And while the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing inside it on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired Altman, its charismatic CEO. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more, Wondery means business. This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu. Israel's war in Gaza took a grim new turn this week as two leading aid organizations, ANERA and the World Central Kitchen, paused their life-sustaining aid deliveries after Israeli forces killed seven World Central Kitchen workers in a convoy that had just delivered food aid in southern Gaza. About 200 aid workers have been killed in Gaza since the war started, among the 32,000 plus Gazans killed. Nearly 90% of Gaza's population of 2.3 million has been displaced, and half of Gazans face famine with no obvious end to the war in sight. So at this really terrible moment, we're joined by Omar Dajani, who's a professor of law at the University of the Pacific and a Palestinian American. So, Omar, can we just start with the consequences of the pause in food aid for Gaza? There's already, what was getting in was already extremely inadequate to the need. What are likely to be the consequences as these two large providers at least temporarily withhold aid until their safety can be more assured?
I think the consequences are really, really worrying. I mean, we were already on the verge for 500,000 people of famine, according to a range of organizations. And for the other 1.5 million people in the Gaza Strip, access to food was already limited. But particularly in the north, this has been an issue that has got everyone really worried, because one of the things that I've learned is that starvation doesn't come suddenly, it comes gradually. The consequences of denial of access to food are not felt overnight, but at a certain point in time, they become incredibly difficult to reverse. And the difficulty here is that it's been compounded. UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, which has been the largest provider of assistance in the Gaza Strip, because such a large proportion of the Palestinians living in Gaza are refugees, has seen its budget slashed as a result of suspensions of aid by the United States, the UK, and other states. And so this perfect storm is emerging, where the combination of Israel's refusal to open up its northern crossing points with the Gaza Strip, like the Erez crossing, which is, you know, a mere 20 miles from Israel's largest port, and the isolation that that's created for northern Gaza, UNRWA's lack of funding, and now these two important NGOs providing that had been providing crucial assistance to hundreds of thousands of people, stopping their efforts. It's hard to know what's going to happen to the folks in northern Gaza as a result.
Right. And, you know, to take a step back, there are these questions of, you know, Israel's tactical goals, which it's still supposed to be eradicating Hamas somehow. And then this larger question about strategy and politics and what happens to Gaza after the war, which the Israeli government has no real answer for, you know, and then how people are supposed to possibly live next to each other or amongst each other after all this incredibly terrible suffering and bloodshed. What do you think the role of the United States is vis-a-vis all of this? And I ask that partly because we're Americans, but also because, you know, President Biden, Chuck Schumer, there has been much more expression of outrage at Bibi Netanyahu and his absolutely horrible leadership. But is rhetoric enough? And if it's not enough, like, what should the U.S. do? Because it seems like we have a lot of leverage that we're really not using.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think one of the big issues, of course, is that the United States is not only not doing enough to ensure compliance with international humanitarian law, to ensure that folks on the ground receive the assistance that they need, but is also arming Israel at an extraordinary pace. And so when we look at the United States' role, it's really as facilitator of Israel's war in the Gaza Strip. And I mean, I was thinking a little about the things that the Biden administration could have done to do more than just gesture its concern about what Israel is up to. And it's a long list. I mean, it could have not vetoed UN Security Council resolutions calling for a ceasefire from October onwards. It could have, after abstaining from a vote on the most recent resolution proposed by the E10, the temporary members of the Security Council, the Biden administration could have refrained from mischaracterizing that resolution as non-binding, which basically undermined the Security Council's position moments after the United States abstained from voting on the resolution. It could have not opposed the International Court of Justice's contentious jurisdiction, or not opposed South Africa's bringing the case before the International Court of Justice. It could have expressed concern after the International Court of Justice in a binding order said that there was a plausible risk to Palestinians of genocide. It could have linked that judgment to the aid situation and insisted that Israel take action at that juncture. It could have suspended military assistance to Israel until Israel assured the United States that aid was freely flowing to the starving population of the Gaza Strip. It could have targeted Israeli leaders such as Bezalel Smotrich, who we know was obstructing United States flour shipments from being transported from Ashdod, Israel's port, into the Gaza Strip. It could have threatened individual sanctions with regard to others who have been involved in obstructing aid. It could have required sooner than 5 months into the war that Israel provide assurances that it was complying with international humanitarian law. And, you know, most recently, and the list goes on, I know it's becoming a bit of a diatribe, but I mean, it could have just this week indicated, as most human rights organizations have, that there are real concerns about Israel's compliance with humanitarian law, both with regard to the kinds of weapons it's using and how it's using those weapons, and with regard to the treatment of the civilian population, rather than having our National Security Council spokesperson blithely say, oh, well, we see no indication that at any point over the last 5 months, Israel has violated a single provision of international humanitarian law. All of that together, that long list, is a real indictment of this administration. I'll say a last thing on this front. I think Peter Beinart really wisely argued this week in his Substack that words without deeds, especially words focused on Bibi Netanyahu, not only do very little to deter Bibi Netanyahu, but actually encourage him, because he's able to say to his public, I'm a strong guy. I stood up to the United States. I stood up to Biden. I don't really like Biden anyway. I'd like to see his opponent elected. And you know what? Again and again, as has been the case for the last number of years, they won't take action against me because I know best how to manage our relationship with the United States.
So, Omar, Netanyahu and Biden are supposed to have a phone conversation on Thursday. The long list that you just went through notwithstanding, what could Biden do now if he decided to move off of this position? I mean, it's amazing when the spokesman for the UN Secretary General responded to the World Central Kitchen deaths and said this is the direct result of a strategy of war that has indiscriminate bombing as a part of it. I thought, well, how long ago was it that Biden mentioned indiscriminate bombings? It was December. So Biden has said there was indiscriminate bombing of Gaza, and that was back in December. But what could he do now if he tried to exert this leverage that was supposed to be what he was purchasing with all of that forbearance that you listed, right? The bear hug, the support for Israel was supposed to give him leverage. How could he apply it if he decided to now in a more forceful way?
I mean, I think one way is by applying this February 2024 National Security Council memorandum, in which the United States basically says, as soon as we have reached the conclusion that you are obstructing the provision of aid, then that affects our ability to provide military assistance. And so, you know, this $18 billion shipment of military assistance to Israel that's just been announced is not something that happens overnight. And presumably the administration is in a good position to very publicly hold things up in ways that can reach the Israeli public, and to make a link between the requirements that the United States law imposes on the administration to say, this isn't us, this is U.S. law that we're undertaking to comply with. And this latest episode really raises some concerns that we've long had that we need to give real time to explore. And I mean, the truth of the matter is that in light of the fact that the Israelis said back in October that it was their intention to starve the population of Gaza, there should be a presumption when actions occur of this kind that they represent potential violations of humanitarian law. So I think the United States could say, hey, we're going to put a hold on this until that moment. But if I may, John, I mean, I think that the other thing Biden is missing the opportunity to do is to speak directly to the Israeli people. I was there in December, and I am in touch a lot with Israeli Jewish friends as well as Palestinian friends there. And I'm struck by how little a sense they have of what is actually occurring in the Gaza Strip, of what Palestinians are experiencing. And I think that one of the great mistakes that President Obama made years ago was making this incredible speech in Cairo in which he promised a new vision and then not reaching out to the Israeli people, leaving that space to Netanyahu. And I think Biden really, either himself or through a very close proxy, needs to begin a direct line of communication with the Israeli people. I think he's been hesitant to do that, but now is the moment, because otherwise Netanyahu will win the war of words.
Do you think that's what they were trying to do with Schumer?
I think that potentially is, but I think Schumer is not the president of the United States. And even though, you know, obviously he's Jewish and that counts for a lot, I think it's different. And I mean, Biden has earned incredible points with Israelis as a consequence of all of this.
Omar, one of the problems that I have as a sort of person who thinks about this is it's so hard for me to discern what the Israelis are really trying to accomplish or what they think happens at the end of this. I'm interested in hearing a Palestinian-American describe, in your mind, I mean, there's been this immense destruction, immense loss of life, immense loss of trust, such as there was. Like, what do you think, from a Palestinian perspective, the aftermath of the war can be in Gaza? What's realistic to hope that happens there?
It's hard to speak about this with anything other than anguish. I don't know if y'all saw Amira Haas, who's an important Israeli journalist who's written for Haaretz for years, wrote a really beautiful and devastating piece a couple weeks ago, in which she lays out the scale of destruction in the Gaza Strip, not so much in terms of physical infrastructure as with regard to the social fiber. Saying, as someone who lived there, as someone who knew the people deeply and well, that what existed there, which was to some extent a reflection of pre-1948 Palestine, all of these communities that reconstituted themselves after the catastrophe of 1948, the Nakba in the Gaza Strip, organized themselves into these communities in that little 22-mile strip, that is shattered. And so the question of how to rebuild it has social and political dimensions as well as logistical dimensions. Now, the international community knows how to begin responding to devastation in a particular area, right? And this area devastated it is, as it is small, and it's totally accessible once war ends. And so when you think about things like infrastructure, it's possible to make relatively rapid progress in addressing people's immediate needs. But when you look at the last number of Gaza wars and the scale of destruction and the lessons that have been learned from the failed attempts at rebuilding, one of the things that's clear is that Gaza cannot be rebuilt unless it is reconnected to the West Bank. And that means restoring movement between the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, and very importantly, giving Gazans the lifeline that that represents in terms of housing and education and opportunities to work also in Israel, which is going to be a big issue, but a crucial thing. And, you know, maybe we'll talk a bit later about a movement that I'm a part of, which really presses for reconceptualizing the best way for Israel and a future Palestinian state to relate to each other, and moves past this idea that separation is the right solution. But even short of a scenario like that, it's really, really important to begin thinking about how to connect these two units together in a way that, you know, had been committed to in the Oslo Accords.
Right. And when you talk about connecting the West Bank and Gaza, I think also obviously that has implications for Israel's occupation of the West Bank, which has to be a crucial part of any list of policy moves that the United States is part of and pushing for. And, you know, right now, I think for Jewish Israelis, ending the occupation seems further away because of the collective trauma of October 7th. But, you know, I think from our perspective, or at least mine as an American, it feels all the more necessary. And the risk that Israel is becoming a pariah state because of the occupation as well as the war seems present. So, yes, could you tell us about A Land for All, which is the group you're part of, which I think has a kind of creative, let's just say, like, it's so hard to imagine any of these things actually happening, but in some future world, tell us about the approach that A Land for All is trying to imagine.
Sure. A Land for All is a movement that's been in existence for more than a decade, but has really kind of constituted itself as an organization as well as a movement in the last few years. And it's organized around a vision. And the vision is a form of a two-state solution. It imagines a Palestinian state being established alongside Israel on the West Bank and Gaza Strip with borders based on the 1967 line. And so in that sense, it looks a lot like what we've been talking about, dreaming about at an earlier stage in what used to be called the peace process for a lot of years. But what's different about it is two things. First of all, instead of embracing the idea of separation, as Ehud Barak put it in his campaign slogan that won him the prime ministership back in 1999, us here, them there, instead of that vision, what A Land for All embraces is a vision in which there are gradual steps with security for both Palestinians and Israelis foregrounded toward freedom of movement and eventually of residence for all Israelis and Palestinians across what we recognize as our shared homeland. We recognize that the length and breadth of this space is precious to Israeli Jews and to Palestinians. This approach, not only to our minds, is responsive to those attachments, but also provides means of addressing some of the issues that prevented us from reaching a deal in the past, whether it's settlements or refugees or Jerusalem, through this vehicle of gradual steps toward freedom of movement, along the lines of what we see in the Schengen system, but in a space 100 times smaller. And to my mind, therefore, all the more capable of being managed from a security perspective. So that's the first piece. And then the second piece is that system would be managed and maintained, and a range of other issues from climate change adaptation to tourism to security would be addressed through a relatively thin layer of confederal institutions. And so whereas we see in Europe a court of human rights, we would also see a joint Israeli-Palestinian court of human rights and Court of Justice and a range of other kinds of commissions to deal with this. And of course, this sort of thing can't be built overnight. And what one of the things that we need to think hard about is how we build a bridge to a vision of that kind. But what our conviction is that instead of taking the approach that folks like Dennis Ross and others have championed for years of like just thinking about what tiny incremental step that we can take at this particular moment without any notion of where that step leads us, that instead we need to reverse engineer. We need to think about the kind of framework that can work for Israelis and Palestinians, because we're going to be there together forever. There's no escaping that, right? And so let's figure out a regime that can actually address our concerns and then think about how we build a bridge to that. And that's what we're trying to do.
Omar Dajani of the University of the Pacific, thanks for coming on the GabFest.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. It's been a pleasure.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
What would a Biden economy be like in a second Biden term? What about a Trump economy in a second Trump term? What do we know about how each of them would govern and how that would affect the economy? So, so many thoughts about this. I've been thinking about this. John, you jump in.
Oh, my God. Yes. Well, I mean, so we've done a number of pieces, and my former colleague, Laura Doan, did a lot of work for Primetime on where we said, okay, what are the questions going to be? The five questions the next presidents are going to have to handle. And like, we've done it three times. So that's 15 different questions. And there are many more to go. You have basically unsustainable debt levels that are rising as a result of spending and interest rates. And the next president and Congress are going to have to manage how to get the debt to GDP ratio in some better shape. Bloomberg did some analysis this week and ran a whole bunch of scenarios about spending and taxes and the challenges that the budget faces. And in 88% of the scenarios, there were varying levels of catastrophe that took place based on policy choices that are likely to be made. And when you think about how dysfunctional the Republican House is right now, it just seems like getting the kinds of agreements on spending and taxes is just going to be incredibly difficult. But then you have things like you have the expiration of the Trump tax cuts, you have trust funds for Social Security, Medicare, and transportation that are either in danger or up for renewal. There are statutory caps on appropriations that expire in October 2025 that will, if those caps, if they expire, are going to create an appetite for even more spending probably. I mentioned that the Trump tax cuts expire. Only the personal tax cuts expire, which is going to be very politically difficult for anybody to support personal taxes increasing. The Affordable Care Act has, there was a temporary expansion of some subsidies under the Affordable Care Act that is also has to be dealt with. That's going to be expensive. And then just briefly, if you look at the global economy, you have massive destabilization in basically all the major economies. China is slowing down, huge market for developing nations and developed nations. If China slows down, there's no market problem. Interest rates are a problem for the developing countries who have huge debt loads. If they can't pay back their debt, it leads to chaos economically, which often leads to political chaos. You've got trade fragmentation that we saw as a result of COVID, but that's continued. Climate change is creating all kinds of economic shocks. These are all things that aren't just, I forgot AI and the challenges it poses to work and the economies of these countries. These are all things that the next president is going to have to manage, not to mention two wars in really crucial areas, Europe and the Middle East. All of that, is going to be a set of economic challenges the next president faces.
So I want to talk about the way I set this up is what the economy of each of these presidencies look like. And I actually think that Trump is a more certain outlook than Biden, because we can pretty much guess what Trump is not going to do anything which he perceives to be painful for himself. He will push off anything that appears to be painful. So there will be no cuts to Social Security. There will be no cuts to Medicare. There will be, you know, he certainly will not. I mean, I suppose it's possible the tax cuts will expire because Democrats will not vote to extend them. But Trump is going to continue to keep taxes as low as possible. So there will be no fixing of anything that needs to be fixed in the long term under a Trump presidency. So I think we can pretty much guarantee that.
Yeah. I mean, and not only that, if you're worried about inflation, Trump policies as articulated would be inflationary, whether you're talking about tariffs that he's promised, whether you're talking about immigration policies that would tighten the labor market even further, pushing up wages. His desire for spending is, as in keeping with your framing, not only will he do nothing that will cause pain, but he will also do lots of spending that will make the budget picture even worse. The only reason I started with all the challenges is I think what the candidates say they're going to do is going to get swamped by reality. And the reason I think that's important is in order to deal with all those things I outlined, you need some worldview that is greater than do no pain to me and my political prospects. You need some worldview about what a government's role is in taking care of people and creating opportunity and freedom and growth in a country. You need some worldview about how to balance taxes and spending. You need some worldview that builds a team that knows how to handle price shocks from wars that are going on, or that knows how to handle the semiconductor race with China. And it's unclear that Trump has ever been interested in building the kind of team that handles any of those issues, but his response to these challenges, to the extent that they come, is episodic and, you know, sort of more stabbing rather than a thought through policy.
Biden, I think, is harder to predict because Biden is very likely, even if he is reelected, in this scenario, he is reelected, but he's almost certainly going to face a Republican Senate, and maybe it's a Republican House or it's a narrow Democratic majority of the House. So his capacity to undertake a Republican Senate, which has a block of anti-Democratic votes that will effectively prevent any major legislation. So I don't think that Biden is going to have the capacity in a second term to undertake any kind of major legislation that is significantly advancing anything that people perceive to be a progressive economic issue. I think there's some trivial possibility that Republicans who want to squeeze Biden would let him cut Medicare or restrain the growth of Medicare and Social Security and have him fall on his sword for that they'd let him do that. But I think mostly we're likely to have sort of a series of government by incremental acts and pushing through budgets that are passed at the last minute that have nothing significant in them. And I think the policy shifts are going to be hard to make anything comprehensive, and certainly nothing that's going to be too strategic, even though they will want to do that. I just don't think that Republicans have the appetite anymore to allow Democrats to do stuff like that.
And what happens to inflation and interest rates?
Well, those are all still in the hands of the Fed. And so, I mean, if the wars create economic shocks that the Fed has to respond to, then in the short term, then, you know, that's nothing that the next president can really handle. The long-term spending and debt level issue is something that the Fed might have to wrestle with, but that's probably not for a while. But it is. But obviously, if the Fed starts cutting rates, in whether it's in the summer or later in the year, that could help the interest on the debt picture. David, just to tie off your point about Medicare and Social Security and Biden cutting it, you mean that in some sort of what they used to call grand bargain, there would be those cuts in exchange for something that Democrats want? Because obviously Biden and the Democrats don't want cuts in those two programs.
Biden and the Democrats don't want it, but I think they also, a lot of fiscally conservative Democrats, of whom there are fewer, feel that there need to be some kind of controls on those two programs and on Medicaid to a certain extent, because there isn't enough tax revenue coming in to fund them anymore. Even if you want them to be at the level they are, there simply isn't the tax revenue coming in. And I don't think because Republicans will not give on taxes, or they don't appear to be willing to give on taxes, it's hard to see where a fiscally responsible person gets except some kind of cut or control for the future.
We should note that Trump is planning on more corporate tax cuts in addition to those that he already passed as a part of his tax cuts when he was in office. You know, the kind of grand bargain that would be necessary to handle these long-term issues wasn't even possible in the days of grand bargains, like in the politics we all covered. And now it's even, you know, further away because of, you know, a lot of the craziness that's happened in the House is the result of outsized, you know, impossible expectations about what one can do with the budget from Republicans. So that mindset, which has caused a lot of chaos in the House, you know, still obviously reigns.
I think a Biden presidency is much less likely to have across-the-board tariffs. It sounds like that Trump really wants an across-the-board tariff on almost everything that's coming in the U.S. And I think Biden will, I suspect, maintain tariffs on China and places that he perceives to be strategically competitive with us. The globalist free trade world has vanished, but Biden will be less aggressive about it. Immigration will almost certainly be more expansive under Biden, and thus there will be more economic growth in the country because there will be more people to work and to drive that. There's one note I have, which is not really about what the future economies would be, but if Biden loses this election, he will be losing in large part because people have been so unhappy about inflation. That inflation has been people's sense that everything costs too much, that the world is unaffordable, even though many people are making more. And even though if you know you look at your real buying power, it's as high as it has been. But people have the sense that inflation has been very bad for them. And I just feel like that if you go back to the Carter presidency, and if Biden loses this election, there is going to be – inflation is the worst enemy of any politician. Inflation isn't the worst thing for an economy, but it is the worst thing for politicians that there is.
But you don't have that much control over it at the same time, right? Like, that's quite a bind to be in. I mean, so listening to both of you, here's what I take away, which I'm raising because maybe it's wrong. What I hear is that if you care about kind of – fiscal responsibility in the longer term, you're better off with a Democratic president who is going to take that seriously. But short-term pain might not be alleviated, partly because Biden isn't in control, the Fed is, but also it just didn't seem to me like I was hearing in either of your answers a kind of sense of like, okay, if my main concern right now is gas prices and housing costs, there's a clear
answer. Short-term pain has been alleviated. The economy's in good shape. People don't feel that the short-term pain has been alleviated, but that doesn't mean it hasn't been. The economy unemployment is incredibly low. Jobs are being created at a record rate. You know, the Dow is at all-time high. Like, inflation is down.
Right. Inflation is down, but not gone. So you feel like this malaise is one of perception, not reality?
I mean, the prices have risen and they are still high. They are not rising at the same rate, but people are still, I mean, they're still paying more for the things. So that's a reality. It's just that the reality that's not a part of the conversation is that we're coming out of a once-in-a-generation global pandemic and expectations are totally out of line with what it's like. I mean, it is an economic miracle that America did not go into a recession. And the global economy actually weathered it all pretty well, considering what happened, which was a massive global pandemic that not only shut down entire economies, but like broke up the global trade structure that everybody was depending on. I mean, there were people who went on TV every day for months, a couple of years ago saying, we're going to have a recession and we're going to have a recession, we're going to have a recession. And they were totally wrong. So David's point is right. I guess I would frame one thing differently, Emily, in your framing, which is, I would say it's not a question of whether you have a Democrat or a Republican in handling these set of challenges that I outlined. It's a question of whether you have a president in the office who believes in collective action through the best minds to address issues that you face. Trump doesn't really believe in the process that would address all of these challenges, as David said, because they require trade-offs and pain and working through a system. And he showed no interest in that whatsoever as president. And he shows even less interest now. And I would then just tack on one thing. If you're in business, presumably you love a Trump presidency because yeah, there might be some chaos, but that's probably just the pundits, and regulations are going to disappear, taxes are going to lower, and like everything that might affect my bottom line will be easier under Trump, either out of neglect or out of policies that actually help me.
And that's a problem for inequality.
Right. I mean, it's right because presumably not every single decision, you know, this is just a theory, but not every decision that private enterprise makes is in the best interests of the entire country.
Let's go to cocktail chatter. When you are having a $26 cocktail because of the Biden inflation that has affected your fancy cocktail bars, Emily, what are you going to be chattering about?
I have two election-related chatters. One is about a decision that Wisconsin voters made this week to pass two amendments that ban election offices in the state from accepting or spending money from outside groups and limit only election officials designated by law to performing all the tasks related to elections. I think these amendments were framed as preventing outside influence. In fact, what happened in elections in 2020 was that outside groups tried to step in to fix the fact that there wasn't enough funding coming into election administrations locally to do a proper job. And so now that is going to be, those resources can't be used in Wisconsin, and that may cause trouble for more people voting in Wisconsin. But it's just interesting how when you frame anything in terms of outside influences, people think that it's bad.
Zuckerbucks. It was Zuckerberg's money.
It was Zuckerberg's money, yes. And that is part of it.
That didn't help.
Right. No, it totally didn't help. Though, of course, Silicon Valley is the place that has the money for this kind of expenditure. On a lighter note, I got some chocolate this week from a chocolate production outfit called Unfair Share. This chocolate is in the shape of a gerrymandered set of state elections. So like the lines that would break the chocolate up into little squares are state lines showing the states with the worst gerrymanders. I think this is pretty clever. Also, it tasted good. It's dark chocolate, but it's 52% cocoa, which like means that it's still kind of sweet, which I confess I'm not a super sophisticated chocolate eater, and I like it when it's a little sweet. So anyway, Unfair Share chocolate, and thank you to Brian Kett for sending it to me. I assume you can buy it somewhere.
Is it a sign of elite tastes that you like bitter chocolate?
I think it kind of is. And I also am not even sure if it's like really true, because my very favorite chocolate bar is still the Lindt milk chocolate bar, which is milk chocolate, not dark.
I mean, if you put down your copy of Joyce's Ulysses and reach for your favorite chocolate sweetmeat, is it going to be some dark thing that tastes like the ashes at the bottom of the coal bucket? Or is it going to be like a sweet Cadbury situation?
I definitely feel that I get looked down on for liking milk chocolate.
I'm a Jacques Derrida 88% cacao person myself.
See?
I really like super bitter chocolate. Cold bitter chocolate is my thing. John, when you're having your Angostura bitters, what are you going to be chattering about?
Okay, so I just have a quick chatter and then the log rolling that we know so well. So the first is the chatter is that moon time is up for debate. There is no agreed upon lunar time zone. But now the White House has asked for one. And the syncing up time on the moon with time on the planet Earth is now something that NASA has to decide by 2026. And this is, time runs differently, by the way, on the moon, because the moon has a weaker gravitational pull than the Earth due to its smaller mass, which means that time moves slightly faster on the moon than on Earth. So anyway, this is important, A, because there's a lot more stuff going zooming to and from the moon now. So for safety's sake, they think that a unified and consistent time zone on the moon would be necessary, but also because, according to the White House memo, this is in advance of full-time, I can't remember whether they said colonization or habitation, but I mean, this is a taste of our permanent residence on the moon. I think that the White House referred to it the capacity to enable an enduring presence.
So like what time zone is it on? Pacific? Eastern?
I don't know. I
24
guess.
24 hours? If it changes, if they don't go at the same rate, how do you keep them on one time zone?
Right now, there is somebody at NASA who is ordering dark chocolate and grabbing their slide rule so that they can spend focused time puzzling out this very sets of questions.
I feel like some edibles might be useful here as well.
Right. Well, if you eat edibles, you are on moon time immediately. Anyway, the other is that April 6th, the first episode of Navel Gazing will drop at 3 a.m. for those of you who are up, which is my 9 audio essays about these notebooks that I have carried with me for the last 30 plus years in my back pocket, and some thoughts that have occurred to me in the process of going back over them. And I hope everybody enjoys it. It's 9 episodes, but the first one drops, and then it'll drop once every week. And we'll all have a little romp through a very brief period of time. But I hope you enjoy it. And thanks for those who listen. I appreciate it.
My chatter, first of all, not really my chatter, but out my window in my new office, my new home office, are these crows who are building, seem to be nesting at the top of a conifer that's in my backyard. And I'm just watching them gather sticks for their nest. And it's amazing. They're so big and impressive looking birds. And I wish them luck. I hope they don't terrorize me. I hope they are my friends or that don't terrorize the dog.
Do they have an opinion about chocolate?
We'll see. I don't know. Leave some out for them. Probably I shouldn't do that. The dog might get it. My actual chatter, though, is last night, my girlfriend and I finished up The Three-Body Problem on Netflix. I thought it was such a great mix. So it's a series based on the first novel in a Chinese sci-fi trilogy.
Which is supposed to be itself amazing.
Yeah, it's kind of. I read the first book and then I tried to read the second book. I thought the first book was good and then it just gets way too. The TV series is much better than the book. Much, much better than the book, in my humble opinion. It's made by the people who made Game of Thrones. And I just think it is a very interesting mix of being awesome and terrible at the same time. It's the unusual TV show in that its deep thoughts are actually really profound. The cosmological parts of it are stunning. And the science is fascinating. The philosophy is genuinely mind-bending, and it really makes you think. And yet the human parts of it are so tedious. The human characters are so annoying for the most part. And it's a real funny watch because every time one of these people is having an emotional problem, you're like, shut up. Let's get to some cosmology.
Is that intentional?
No, I don't think so. I think it's just poorly acted.
Interesting. I mean, I thought some of them were annoying, but I liked some of them. You didn't like any of them? You didn't like Clarence? You didn't like the older Chinese woman?
Yeah, he's fine.
His name
he's
is
fine.
Not in my head.
Clarence is fine, and the boss guy, Wade, is good. And I actually watch a lot of sci-fi TV. So there's The Foundation. I would contrast this one with Foundation, which I think is both cosmologically terrible and also emotionally dreary.
I think I'll see
For All Mankind, which I think is cosmologically really great and also emotionally great. Because For All Mankind is a great sci-fi series. This one is somewhere in between.
When you're speaking about cosmologically, do you mean in terms of world building, that the world that it creates is fascinating, or do you mean something
else? I think
a
mix of the world that it creates and the philosophical questions that it proposes and grapples with, and does it grapple with them in a way that sparks your imagination. And Foundation absolutely did not as a TV series. And this Three-Body Problem absolutely did. And For All Mankind absolutely did.
We are slogging through Foundation. And I must say that nothing in your recommendation has...
I think Foundation is shockingly terrible. And the second season, which I gave one episode to, was among the worst things I've ever seen on television. Listeners, you've got chatters. Please keep them coming. We're actually in slightly short supply. We need your chatters. What are you talking about at your cocktail parties? Have you had an experience with pyramids you'd like to share? Have you had an experience with crows you'd like to share? Has someone sent you chocolate that you'd like to talk about? Please email us at gabfest@slate.com and tell us your chatter. And our listener chatter today comes from Kim in Spartanburg, South Carolina. Great town. I've been there.
Hi, GabFest. This is Kim in Spartanburg, South Carolina, and my chatter is about the return this spring of the world's first fish doorbell. In the city of Utrecht in the Netherlands, many thousands of fish swim up the rivers and canals to spawn and reproduce. But a boat lock that rarely is open during the springtime creates a barrier in the water. So in 2021, local ecologists installed an underwater camera at the lock and live-streamed the video on the website Vesterbel, which is Dutch for fish doorbell. If viewers of the live stream see fish congregating at the lock, they click a button on the website that acts as a doorbell on behalf of the fish and notifies the local lock operator, who can then check for himself whether or not to open the lock. Doing so allows the fish to continue on their journey and avoid getting eaten by predators. The ecologist who invented the fish doorbell told The Guardian last year that he knew he couldn't watch the camera 24/7 and initially went door to door, seeing if locals would be interested in helping out for a few minutes per day. Today, the fish doorbell is something of a viral sensation. I first learned about it from a TikTok video shared by Thunder Keck, a former Stanford football player who has over a million followers. Thanks, GabFest. This show and everyone's cocktail chatters are always a highlight of my week.
That's our show for today. The GabFest is produced by Jared Downing today because Shayna is off on vacation, I hope. Our researcher is Julie Hugan, who is not off on vacation. Our theme music is by They Might Be Giants. I was emailing with them. They have a studio album coming out very soon. They're working on their 24th studio album. 24 albums. 24.
Wow.
That's a lot of albums. Ben Richmond is Senior Director for Podcast Operations. He helped me out with something this week. Alicia Montgomery is the VP of Audio of Slate. She helps us out every week. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson and David Plotz, thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week. Hello, Slate Plus. How are you? If you were me, you're eagerly looking at the weather forecast in northern Vermont for Monday, because on Monday in the afternoon, there will be a total solar eclipse across much of the United States, sweeping up from Texas all the way and through to Maine and hitting a whole bunch of states along the way, Arkansas, Ohio, upstate New York, a lot of Vermont, a lot of Maine. Are you guys going to get a chance? Yeah, I'm going to Vermont. I'm driving up on Saturday with my whole family is going to be there, extended family, because we have a place up in northern Vermont. And we just thought.
Is it in the path of totality?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome.
Our David Parkinson, senior weather producer, who's a fabulous explainer of weather things, was on this week talking.
That was just a snippet from our Slate Plus conversation. If you want to hear the whole conversation, go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to become a member today.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.